Sustain 267.
Welcome to the Sustain 267 podcast, where we host conversations on different issues affecting climate change in Botswana and the rest of Africa. I'm your host, Patokile Sitse. Today we'll be looking at the politics of climate change, but that's very broad. So specifically, political will, politicians' will to act on climate change. If you remember, as recently as February, there were no government regulations around COVID-19 or even a budget for it in any African country. Within almost a blink of an eye, in Botswana specifically, we had regulations that cost millions. Who would have thought in such a short time governments can move so quickly and be so efficient? I'm not even talking small changes. Botswana literally being told to stay home and not to dare step out without a permit, or they will get a very hefty fine of, I think it's between 1,000 and 5,000 bula, which is about 100 to 500 US dollars. Closing down businesses a few months ago would have been political suicide, to say the least. Yet the government put orders in place to close all but essential service businesses because to address COVID-19, and there was a will to address COVID-19. Now crossing over to climate change. Unlike COVID-19, it's a much slower process, but it's one that requires dramatic, swift actions from our leaders. COVID-19 has shown us what is possible with government policies and regulations and how swift they can be and how swift our governments can be to address impending crisis. But today we're not talking about policy. We're taking a few steps back and discussing political will. There's been a lot of talk on platforms such as COP and regional climate meetings, but is there follow through and is there action? Before we even get to action, is there a will to act from our politically elected African leaders? I will be having this conversation with Director of Mensa Advisory, Greenpeace Africa's Senior Political Advisor and Senior Climate and Energy Campaign Manager, and a member of the Resilient 40, Happy Kambule.
My first question would be, I have an idea of what the response may be, but from an expert, is there a political will to address climate change from our African leaders?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I should be asking you what you think the answer will be first, and then we could take it from there. But I guess to be honest, there isn't real political will to address climate change or the climate emergency, or in this case, as we're starting to articulate it as the climate crisis. And the reason for one to believe that there isn't one and one to understand that there isn't one, meaning the political will, is that first and foremost, it's not that it's not present, it's just not there in the necessary way that we need it to be. And what that means is, if there's political will to undertake a particular action, and a good example is the response to COVID-19, hard decisions are made and very difficult decisions are made. And the population who's subject to those decisions tend to understand the reasoning, as well as the extent to which the decision is important and necessary. Whereas with the climate crisis or climate change, the greater proportions of the population are starting to understand that there is a thing called climate change and that big decisions need to be made. But the political class and the elites that we live under and live with just don't want to make those decisions because it still serves them in order to keep things as they are. So the political will to address climate change is not necessarily there, although one might argue that it is probably growing.
So if it's a thing of addressing this, fine, currently might not serve the political elite. Unfortunately, they're the ones, to some degree, we could say, who have the power to change it. How do we then motivate the political will in them?
Well, so if we think about it in the sense that the political will is manifested in different ways, and we as society tend to invest the authority to make decisions and invest our power in those who are the political elite or the political class. And what they tend to do is they manifest what we want as a key issue, and they undertake those necessary steps, processes in order to achieve that. So part of it may be, and this is what civil society around the world has been trying to do, is to say, maybe it's not just the politicians and the bureaucrats that need to be heightened and shown that this thing is a real problem, but also just society. The more society starts to show discontent, the more society starts to speak about the problem, and the more society wants answers, that's when the will and the necessary need to address those questions is manifested through political will. So, for example, if we consider that last year and this year, we've been having a lot of environmental, I don't want to say pandemics, but epidemics in many regions in Africa and in the global south, where new forms of pests or new forms of crop diseases or new forms of heightened and really intensified forms of zoonotic diseases are starting to pop up. That forces whoever is the closest political principle to address it. But if they're unable to show that this has an impact on the broader and the macro social fabric of maybe the population and or the society, they then don't get the necessary power to be able to push what they need to push. So the agricultural political principle is unable to say, we actually need a state of disaster around our food crops because the locusts have just decimated everything. And 2 years ago or a year ago, we had the fall armyworm that destroyed almost half of our maize crops, which is more or less a staple crop for many countries. Because there aren't enough people talking about it, and because there aren't enough people raising the voice of this is really a problem, we don't see those political principles acting in a way which shows that they understand what the problem is. So they basically fall in line with whatever is happening and what has to be dealt with. So civil society has seen that and said, look, maybe the problem is not only addressing it through policies and lobbying and political engagement, but it's really about creating movements on the ground that reflects the different instances of climate change. And that's when I say there is a change in sentiment. It's just that we can't articulate it as well as we should, because it's still emerging.
Picking up on the articulation, I think one of the reasons I started the podcast was because I felt like the conversation was between politicians in boardrooms. So even if we were to demand action on it and we were to demand policies addressing it, it would be a thing of how do we even start? There's a worm that ate my maize. Then?
What's next?
then it's silence because the government is like, yeah, but so possibly how do we then bring that together? How do we bring on the citizens into the conversation and for them to then speak with one voice and demand action on this thing called climate change? That, I mean, even climate change, hello, what is it? Do you know, in different languages when we have that conversation?
I'm scared to even think about what it means to communicate climate change effectively in a continent with millions of languages. But I think in us being able to articulate what the climate crisis is better, it is easier for people to understand it, and they can then interpret it and re-disseminate the information in a manner which fits not only the conditions that they're living in, but also the political context. So it's really about those who are already engaged in it to be able to explain it so well, and to give solutions in such a manner that it allows whoever is listening in to resonate with it and then to act on it. So an example of this is maybe the BLM movement, the Black Lives Matter movement. It's not really only about police brutality, right? In different countries, it manifests itself as a different thing, but it's really about the systematic oppression of people who are non-white, but particularly African or African descent. So in our articulation of climate change in Africa or the climate crisis, we have to start to do it in such a manner that enables us to also leave space for those who are also impacted by it in a different context to also articulate it, and it resonates in the same light. The problem is that Africa has been unable to do that. African intellectuals or African communicators have been unable to articulate this problem in such a manner that it resonates with the core base of Africans in our continent. What we are using, which is not a fault of anyone, but just the system we're in, is that we're largely using European, United States, and sometimes Asian articulations of the problem, answers to the problem, but those are not the ones that would fit the purpose of where Africa is. Africa is highly, highly diverse, and Africa is highly, highly vulnerable to climate change. So if we're talking about the capacity to not only communicate it, it's about language, as you said. If we're talking about the capacity to address it, it's also about capability. And if we're talking about the capability or the ability to generate the resources that would enable a government or the political principles to do something about it, then we're talking about the economics. So it's very different for someone in Europe to begin a conversation on climate change versus someone in Africa, because the European example, or someone who's from the first world, whatever they call themselves, the North or the Western civilized countries and the more affluent Asian countries, is that they don't have the same barriers or the same limitations as Africans have, or nor do they have the same conditions. They don't have the added steps that they need to encounter, and nor do they have to deal with, in many cases, nor do they have to deal with the first piece of the puzzle, which is the material conditions that we live in. So if you're in Southern Africa, you know exactly about aridness of land and the need for not only land ownership, but access to arable land that you can use. And whereas in other countries, in like other continents, that's not a problem, right? They are dealing with more or less the systemic issues rather than the material issues that people need to address.
And also, as you're talking about the different challenges that we face, it also becomes a thing of, could it also be a thing of priorities? You know, right now, yes, we're pushing for political will, we're pushing for climate change to be addressed. But like you said, we have so many other problems. We're talking about unemployment, we're talking about poverty. In some areas of Africa, we're even talking about civil wars. And these are things that are in your face, that you can see physically. When we say civil war, there's a dead body in front of you. When we say unemployment, you've got bills and you're at home and you're not making money. When we say poverty, you can feel it in your tummy. As climate change, I guess now for, it's kind of a concept, we could say. It's, you see it, but all of these, you feel them more. So it's, how do we then increase the volume on climate change and the climate change message? Not increase the volume to drown out the others, but so that it's also heard.
I think in this case, we need to take a page from the feminist movement and really leverage intersectionality. We've clearly seen from the development of different governance structures within Africa and the different political powers within Africa that you can't have an isolated unicorn in Africa to spare the rest of Africa to do good, right? We need everybody to play their role. So if a particular country, let's say DRC, is in turmoil and the rest of the countries around there are not in turmoil, what you would hope is that those other countries can force the situation in DRC to be a better situation, and there's less wars and there's less conflict and less dead bodies. But we're in a situation where we are not looking at things as they intersect. Our understanding, and I think as Africans, we tend to forget that, is that we are not traditionally nationalist, and we're not traditionally ones who try to hoard things, right? We try to share as much as possible, because the village or the community next to me, if it's doing good and I'm doing good, there's less likelihood of there being friction. There's less likelihood of there being war or a fight over water resources. So if we're looking at it in an intersectional manner, what we could be thinking about and what we should be doing, which is already happening anyway, is that the problem of civil war doesn't in itself exclude that climate is a driver. What we do know from science is that climate change has been happening for years. How we understand its impacts is only emerging lately because of all the historical evidence that we've had. And it's not something that just happened now. It's not going to happen in the future. It's been happening. The sub-Saharan region has been slowly becoming drier. But in increasing years, the effects of that dryness are becoming more prevalent. And that means that issues of poverty, issues of inequality, issues of conflict, issues of I guess in this case, employment and economic opportunities, issues of stability, they all come to the fore. So then you ask yourself, to what extent is the climate crisis playing a role as a driver for these things? So in us addressing these things, we should be considering to what extent are we adapting to climate change so that these things don't happen again, leaving us vulnerable. So we're increasing our vulnerability, but also making sure that we're not contributing to a situation where, again, should drying happen, or in another case, precipitation becomes more, we're not stuck in a situation where it's bad. So it's really about addressing the problem in an intersectional way, making sure that we're not stuck in the same situation after we've addressed it. If it kind of makes sense, it's really taking a book or taking a lesson from the feminist movement.
Snap, the feminist movement, I'm here for it. You know what? Yes, in terms of intersectionality and addressing a number of issues at the same time, there's some beautiful work being done there. Yeah. And then when you speak of the climate wars and the drying up and desertification and how that then contributes to poverty, first thing that jumps to mind is the drying up of Lake Chad. And now in Nigeria, you literally have farmers killing each other for access to water.
I only keep quiet because I think every time we talk about conflict, it's only, and especially when there's death in the mix, it's always necessary to give a moment of silence, because what it really means is that people are dying unnecessarily because of the decisions, not only as a society we are taking, but also by the people who we've vested the power to take those decisions. We shouldn't be in a situation, and bureaucrats, people who are working at a continental level, global level, in institutions that are working on governance and finding solutions to these things, they all know that these kinds of situations shouldn't be happening. There should be safeguards for something like Lake Chad, or for the Nile for that reason, or for any other water resource out there. There shouldn't be situations where just because there's a variability of the resource, of the variability of access to the resource, shouldn't create conflict. But it is, and it's not even just a once-off conflict, it's a generational conflict, meaning that we're still not addressing certain things. And on top of that, meaning that people are starting to grow with not only the conflict being a constant thing and no longer a variable or no longer a once-off thing that happened once and it got addressed, but it becomes part of their DNA, their identity, to be able to fight either each other or for the right to access to a diminishing resource, which makes things even worse, to find a solution. But these things are known of, and these things have been seen, or rather predicted in the sense of models, or forecasted in a sense beforehand. It's whether or not the people who are necessarily need to act actually act. And that's where the political will comes in, is that the information is there. They all know these things, but they're not acting on the different farmers and the farmers and the livestock herders who are fighting in Somaliland, for example. The people who are being displaced by oil companies so that more greenhouse gases can be pushed out by using a technology that is outdated, that no longer needs to be there because, hey, it just fits the purpose and people can still benefit from it who are already benefiting from it. So the question really is sitting that if there's conflict and we can address it and we know how we can address it, why aren't we doing it? And if we know that climate is a driver, why aren't we creating the necessary safeguards in order to address climate to ensure that there isn't more conflict? But they know the answers to these things. They do. Some of them, yes, are more complex and they need longer time. But if we don't act now, then we're probably not going to have a Lake Chad that is accessible to any particular person. Because as soon as people get displaced, someone else moves in there. And that person who moves in there is more ruthless than the two warring families or the two warring communities. And we're talking about transnational companies and even being spurred on by the politicians, because there's a resource there that needs to be taken. If it happens that there's a resource that is needed, for example, in the United States or in any other country that's got money, they make hay and they make way in order to get it, regardless if there is conflict, meaning that they are able to fix a problem should they need to. And they need to, but they just don't feel like they do, because it still works for them.
Exactly. And when the big companies come in, there will be a will and they will make a way. Who is then removed in creating that way? That's really not going to be something that bothers them much. Going back to a point that you raised on our leaders and the people who we vested our trust in to lead us, starting with America, we've seen America completely step out of the Paris Agreement. When our leaders usually go for these engagements, it's a thing of asking the global north or the more developed countries for money to then take necessary actions in addressing climate change. Seeing countries like the United States pulling out of the Paris Agreement, how is that translating to our leaders, and how are we seeing that manifest in our leadership and our political will? Because that's a strong voice making a strong voice by pulling out of the Paris Agreement. How are we seeing it manifest in Africa?
You know, in the beginning when the United States withdrew, people thought that doesn't mean much, you know. I mean, of course, there were voices that says this is too important to let go. But to give you an anecdote, when the United States was about to pull out, or not even pull out, but when we knew that the president of the United States is going to be the current president, it was that the election was happening during the Marrakesh COP, right? And what happened is the day before, I think it was day two or day three, if there was a good sense of things are about to change, in the sense that there was a great atmosphere of if the then running or person who was running for the presidency, Hillary Clinton, was going to win, things were going to more or less remain the same. The United States is staying and actually is going to play a bigger role. So people were anticipating that announcement, were anticipating in the speech that she takes on or writes as a result of being a president-elect, it will give prominence to climate change. There was a very large group of Africans who were very clear to say that they do not see the win happen. But that voice and that understanding of that it is possible that a non-progressive voice within the United States or any territory could win and change the dynamics was not recognized, because also it's coming from African voices, right? The second thing, and as part of the anecdote, is that the global community had a chance and did try to safeguard the Paris Agreement in terms of its process and in terms of its, not necessarily compliance, but its membership, protected in such a way that if you do leave, you leave within a certain time period, but you should have implemented something in between. What was not thought of, right, was the actual impact on the psyche of the rest of the world around withdrawing. Because the two things now that we have learned, the first one is the United States as an imperialist government, and I use that word deliberately because that's how it acted, is that in Kyoto, it did the same, right? It negotiated in Kyoto in a particular way, knowing that it would be able to enforce it if it was participating. But then when it had to participate, it withdrew. The same thing happened with the Paris Agreement, and there weren't enough safeguards as they should have been, but there were a safeguard, there were a few safeguards as compared to Kyoto. But what has happened is that through the signal that it has sent out, the other political powers of the world, whether it's your Brazil, it's the China's or whatever, they're also starting to see whether or not they can wiggle their way out of being active on climate or participating on climate, just because they're able to do it because they've seen the imperial power do it. And if they can't be held accountable as an imperial power, why would anyone else be held accountable? So you'll see a lot of governments now are not enhancing their NDCs. They're adjusting their NDCs. They're using a proviso within the, and it's mostly linked to the mitigation component of the nationally determined contributions within the Paris Agreement that allows you to adjust versus you enhancing your NDC. And that's basically countries stepping back. That's basically the political players of the world stepping back from the need to increase ambition, because we all know that the current NDCs are leaving us to a certain point, which is 3 to 5 degrees, and they need to increase collectively their ambition. But now they don't want to, because they want to revise as a result of the United States pulling themselves out. So it had a fundamental shift, not only at the geopolitical level because of other issues, like also considering how multilateralism works, as well as the impact of just having a nationalist, almost, and I would say not almost, but a racist government or administration in the United States has resulted in other versions of something similar in other countries, which in turn also undermine climate action and the international response to international issues such as climate change or environmental destruction or conflict.
The chain of actions reminds me of just in a household, you know, if you've got 5 children and you're strict with 4, but let one get their own way, eventually these other 4 are also going to step out of line. You see, for anyone who's curious about what NDCs and COP are, as mentioned by Happy, there's an earlier episode on the Paris Agreement and NDCs where we addressed what some of these are. The episode is Trust the Scientists. Please do give it a listen for clarity on that bit. And then as we come to a close, Happy, ideally, in a perfect world, if we could have political will, what would it look like? We talk of not having enough political will, but if it was there, what is this thing that we are looking for? What would it look like? What would it manifest as around climate change? And
see, that's a very deep question. And I try not to think in futurist terms, but I guess I got no choice in this case. The thing I think which is important for a sense of action by politicians, but also manifesting the will of the people, which would be the political will in this case, it's really that we are able, and this is where it's a bit dicey, is that we are able to do as people, as the information that is sound and that is scientific in this case, that is verifiable, needs us to do. And that means in some cases, and I guess in our case, Botswana, South Africa, and largely the African continent, is that the democratic spaces that have been created, or the opening of democratic spaces, needs to be there. So we need to safeguard certain things. The ability to voice, participate, associate, and do as it is required by not only science, but for the greater good is one. The second part is really that there is a sense of accountability for inaction. And if we are taking this more literally, is that we can't be in a situation where Africa is being pillaged, right, by multinational companies that are beholden and all are in cahoots with domestic elites, as well as the international community and the global powers. And at the same time, saying we're addressing climate change, because the exploitation of Africa in itself is part of the reason why Africa is so vulnerable to climate change. Most of the world's resources still come from Africa. Most of the revenue that is being generated is coming from Africa. And the least amount of inflows of money or of that revenue that is being generated in Africa is not in Africa. It goes outside. So the capability for us to adopt, to adapt, and to mitigate are actually sitting in our hands, but we are unable to use them because of the decisions we're making. So the first thing would be, there is no reason why we should keep on exploiting oil, coal, gas for international markets and for domestic markets when the real revenues, the real benefits of those things are not flowing to the people. That's the first thing. So obviously that eliminates it not only on an environmental perspective, but also on a social perspective, because the things that we need to do to develop are not being done. So we then start to say there's a decisive decision that no new coal plants need to be done. And that's a political decision that leads to other ramifications. But we need to be honest about what it means. It means people might lose jobs or will lose jobs, but what does it mean for the new world? What does it mean for a new Africa to no longer be the place where everything is taken from and nothing is given back? And that's really at a political level a decision that needs to be taken. Some people, obviously, depending on what is being said, will be painted in different ways, either nationalist or militant. But if the entire or majority of the class, of the political class of Africa, basically says, no more pillaging of Africa, we're going to do things on our own and we're going to take care of our people because we have screwed up this long and that's why we're in this position, it changes the dynamics. The bargaining power of Africa is different, the ability to do what it needs is different, and the accountability to its citizens by those who are placed by them becomes different because they're no longer beholden to transnational companies and superpowers.
Definitely. There is a sense of accountability for inaction in political will. Your closing statement, the whole time I was just mute myself because I was like, yes, yes. Happy, thank you so much for making time to speak to me.
Still in Southern Africa and keeping to Botswana's neighbors, this week on Africa Bites, I had a chat with fellow Resilient 40 member David Nyamuronda from Zimbabwe, who's working for Caritas Zimbabwe, which is the social development arm of the Catholic Church. As usual, my first question to him was, what is climate change in the way that you understand it?
From what I've gathered during all this time, is that the climate change is weather patterns. Depending also with the region and also from which part of the world you are. But basically, I can say change the patterns.
Okay. And how has it affected you directly, if it's affected you at all directly?
Yes, I can say climate change has affected everyone, be it our lifestyle and also even our work. It has affected our work, our lifestyle big time. For example, if you look at some of the droughts that we are facing, even in Zimbabwe, it's a result of climate change. Some of the changes also even in the work that we do, it's a result of climate change. So I can say it affected me big time.
And what have your contributions been towards addressing it, seeing as it has affected you, if any?
When I look at the contributions that we have made, as a person who is working sector, yes, for the past 5-6 years, we have been working with communities, be it rural communities, so urban communities, in trying also to address these issues of climate change. So as an organization or people, what we have tried to do is to do awareness campaigns in terms of climate change, make people aware that is a reality and we need to do something. And also looking at some of the works that we've done on the ground. In Zimbabwe, I can say we have been very much affected by drought. We have helped communities to be resilient to climate change and also to some of these disasters when they come, drought and even cyclones. So these are some of the contributions that we try by all means to give to the community, to make people aware, to be prepared. We need to prepare our communities, even to prepare our minds in terms of climate change and the disasters.
Do you feel that there's political will to address climate change?
Yes, I can say, but I think it's very, very low. When I look at my country, Zimbabwe, I think a third of the people, probably, I can say, they are so much into climate. And the rest, sometimes you can tell that, yes, they can tell you a word or two about climate change. Probably we need to do more so that people, there is that will to talk more about climate change or even to act when it comes to climate change. So I can say the political will is very low.
Okay. And if there was one action that everyone could take towards addressing climate change, what would you like that action to be? What's the one action you would encourage to take?
Maybe in Zimbabwe and in Africa, we need to help. We need to do the awareness campaigns things about climate change. Probably that would be the starting point before getting into more practical things like planting of trees. Probably we need to have discussions about climate change. When we discuss more now, we get more into practical.
In closing, what do you wish everyone knew about climate change?
People should know that climate change is a reality. And if you don't play your part, no one will do. So we need to have a hand. We need to play our part as far as concerned. So that at least when we begin to talk, we have discussions about climate change, people should get involved. You talked about the will actually to talk more about climate change. Some people, they think it's for certain people, not for me. So there is needed, and also we need to commit ourselves when we look at climate change.
Okay. David, thank you so much for joining me in conversation.
Thank you for taking time to listen to this week's episode of Sustain 267. I'll be posting new episodes every week of conversations on climate change and sustainability in Botswana and the rest of Africa. As you may know, this podcast is self-funded and fueled by my passion as a climate change enthusiast. I truly, 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 from the bottom of my heart, appreciate the support that you give by listening to the weekly episodes. However, if you'd like to take your support a step further and support the production of the podcast financially, please become a patron on my Patreon page. Tiers start from as low as 30 pula or $3 a month. I'll include the link to my Patreon in the episode description. I am the host of Sustain 267, Batokili Sitse, and the sound engineer is Maleho Makhod. Like our Facebook page, Sustain 267, we will also be sharing this episode and continuing the conversation. Please share your thoughts on political will on climate change in Africa. Do you think there's political will to address climate change? Where there's a will, there's a way. It's still on and our lives are still potentially in danger and others being lost. Let's continue to follow government regulations so we stay safe. Take care.
Sustain 267.